We will now look at the example of St. Peter, drawing primarily from the scriptures, and I've chosen 9 separate segments that illustrate events in Peter's life and ministry taken from the Gospels, as well as at the very end, a selection from an apocryphal text that tells the popular Quo Vadis story, the story of Peter leaving Rome and then deciding to go back in order to be martyred after an encounter with Christ. And of course, that apocryphal story gives us an insight not so much into Peter as into the mindset of the early church, probably the second century, and what the sorts of things people were thinking about or reflecting on, how Peter's experience and ministry was viewed at that time, what kinds of symbols were used to reflect on the nature of who Peter was. And as we'll see, in Peter we have this brilliant example of one who is both church leader and disciple, who is called specially by the Lord to a ministry of leadership in the church, which is then communicated to the rest of the apostles, but whose relationship and responsibility is seen as somehow uniquely given, as we'll see. But at the same time, he's also an example of regular, not exactly constant, but repetitious failure. Peter crumbles at various points in his ministry. He's not able to get it. He leaps when he should refrain. He promises to do things he can't do, and then discovers to his deep frustration that he's misunderstood the whole thing. And each time, there is the possibility of a restoration. So Peter stands for the possibility of a ministry of reconciliation within the church. No matter what you've done, no matter how terrible the betrayal may have been, there's always a way back. The community will find a way back through the ministry of the compassionate Christ. So Peter's life and his example becomes a reminder of the fact that there is this ministry that reconciles within the context of the Christian community. And so he's an example of both the possibility of being restored, but also the fact of a leadership which is itself a means of restoration, but is also itself in a process of formation. Church leaders are, in Christianity, not semi-divine beings. Christians do not regard their leaders in the same way that, say, the members of the Egyptian religion of old would have. They're not a quasi-divine oracles. They are human beings capable of failure, capable of radical misunderstanding, but in an increasingly deepening relationship with their Lord, they can be restored in ways that allow them to become things they never imagined. Let's look at the examples we have from these texts. First of all, from the 5th chapter of St. Luke's Gospel, this first example is Peter's call. And notice how astonishing, how really quite beautiful this text is. It begins with Peter's own profession. Peter is called where he is with the skills that he has, and although he leaves fishing behind, Christ uses Peter's gift of fishing as a way of deepening, highlighting what it is that Peter is to do. The story with which we're all familiar, Peter is fishing, the Lord comes by, the Lord says, put out into the deep, eis to bathos, in order to let down your nets for a catch. Simon Peter is indignant at this. After all, he's the fisherman, but he agrees to do it. And when they have the miraculous catch of fish, Peter is penitent because at some level he has in this experience seen who Christ is. Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord, Kyrie. So even in this initial call, we have the example of Peter seeing who Christ is, articulating that for the rest of the church. He is the one who sees who Christ is, and yet needs to, at some level, is aware of his need for being restored, for being made more than he is at this moment. And Christ says, don't be afraid. Henceforth, you will be catching men, human beings. This gift which Peter already has, this profession he already exercises, is now going to be deepened and enabled to be widened into the context of evangelism. And here again, we remind ourselves that this is very different from the model of master and disciple in classical philosophy, where the disciple seeks out the master, here it's the other way around. God comes to us. Christ comes to the disciples and calls them, knows who they are, takes what they are, and enables it to be deepened, strengthened, and in some cases, after having been broken, for it to be restored and re-strengthened. Peter is in the second example from the 8th chapter of St. Luke's Gospel, present in Jesus' ministries of healing. He is, at this point, the spokesman for the disciples, as he often is. And here we're reminded of the fact that Peter really is the only of the disciples, the only of the apostles, about whom there are so many vignettes, so many stories, about whom there are so many recorded dialogues that one can begin to fashion a sense of empathy with the individual, a sense of identification with him as a model of discipleship, see him clearly as an individual and not just as one of the great mass of apostles. Peter here is the one who says, in an almost perplexed sort of way, when Jesus asks who has touched him, Master, the multitudes surround you and press upon you. Well, as the story develops, as the woman is healed, and then as the daughter of the synagogue leader, Jairus, asks Jesus to come to his house, here we have a selection of a group of individuals from within the College of Apostles. There is this broad group, almost unnumbered, of Jesus' disciples. Then there are the 12 apostles who are specifically called in a very unique kind of way. And within the 12, there is this group of three, Peter, James, and John, who are present in a variety of places, here singled out for mention in this ministry of healing. He permitted no one to enter with him except Peter, James, and John. And we'll see that this recurs on the Mountain of Transfiguration. It's also highlighted in the context of the Passion narratives as well. There is a sense that even within the group of those who stand for church leadership, the apostles, there is a kind of a, what you might call an inner circle, those who are entrusted with a particular kind of closeness of ministry and then of authority, Peter, James, and John. And then, of course, Peter is highlighted out for special treatment, as we shall see. Number three, walking on the water. Here we have an example of Peter's perception. The waves are suddenly present. Everybody is terrified. But when Jesus says, have no fear, take heart, Peter says, if it is you, bid me come to you on the water. Peter sees who Christ is and what Christ can do. He gets out of the boat. He has a little bit of success, but begins to sink. And he becomes an example both of eager faith and of failure of faith. O man of little faith, why did you doubt? And he's restored. He gets back into the boat. So Peter is the eager apostle, the eager disciple, and yet the one who also fails and is in need of restoration right here in St. Matthew's Gospel before the rather more obvious examples of this. Then, in the 16th chapter of Matthew's Gospel, vignette number 4, if you will, Peter's confession of faith, here is Peter's unique call and vocation, and even what you might call the anti-papal or not particularly fond of the claims of the of papal authority, exegetes like Oscar Kuhlmann admit that there really isn't any way to interpret this astonishing exchange in Caesarea Philippi other than to say that Jesus is commending leadership of the church to Peter. You are Peter. On this rock, the rock which is the now Peter's name, his new name, and the rock is, of course, his confession of faith. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. But on this rock, both of faith and of person, the church will be built. The power of hell shall not prevail against it. Now, of course, the ministry of binding and of loosing is also given to the other disciples, but there is something very unique about the kind of leadership with which Peter is entrusted, which is beautifully paralleled by Peter's failures, by his repeated excessive promises and then incapacity to fulfill. It's almost as if the very early church is being invited to reflect on the nature of ministry and of leadership within the church, that to see leadership is not just to see oracular figures who are never in need of any deepening in their spirituality or of growth, but on the contrary, one sees human beings who are leaders precisely because they are dependent on their relationship with God for restoration once they have fallen or crumbled, as Peter does, and he does immediately. Just as they're stepping away from this after having made that glorious confession of faith, Peter cannot accept Christ's suffering. He can't understand what that corresponds to. "God forbid, Lord," he says in verse 22. And Jesus says the terrible words, "Get behind me, Satan." Hypage opizo mu satana. And he says to Peter, "You are a stumbling block, skandalon." So the same one who articulates the statement of faith, the beautiful description of who Christ is, who sees who the Lord is, can't see what that means, and he becomes the spokesman, not of truth, but of scandal. So Peter then is again in need of restoration. "If anyone would come after him, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me." So the cross is clearly placed before the disciples as a model which they must follow, and which Peter has not understood. Then at the Transfiguration, Peter, James, and John again are brought up to this place where in a beautiful, glorious, and almost physical way, they see truly who Christ is. The divinity of the Lord shining forth. We've already looked at the significance of this word, metamorphosis, which is also used by St. Paul to describe our own transfiguration or transformation. Here, Peter, James, and John see who Christ is. He is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets, which is what his dialogue with Moses and Elijah describes. And Peter, again, is the spokesman for the apostles. "I will make three booths here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." Peter is invoking a liturgical context. He's reminding them and being reminded of the Feast of Booths in Judaism. And as the one who articulates the faith of the developing church, he is creating a sense of a sacred site, a sacred place, again, almost a kind of a liturgical validation of what this event means. And they are commended to secrecy. And again, the next text we'll be looking at is a reminder that it's possible both to get it wrong, but then, having recognized one's mistake, to deepen in relationship with Christ in a way that allows one to see an even deeper and more fundamental truth. Who is the greatest? Luke 22, this vignette number 6. Jesus reminds his disciples who are talking about who's the greatest. "Let the greatest become as the youngest," become as those who are least regarded in society, least regarded in hierarchies, and the leader, the hegumenos, which is the same word that is used particularly in the Eastern Church to describe the abbot or leader of a monastic community, the leader, the hegumenos, must be hos hod diakonon, as the one who is serving, as the one who is engaged in a ministry of service. So leadership means service, according to Christ, and having spoken of leadership, of servant leadership, then Christ speaks about what will happen to a kind of a prophetic anticipation of Peter's own betrayal, Peter's own denial of Christ, and yet Christ's affirming ahead of time that there will be even after that the possibility of new life. "Simon, Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. When you have turned again," epistrepsos, when you have turned back again, when you have repented effectively, recovered yourself, then strengthen your brethren. So this is an anticipation of a ministry which Peter will have because of his betrayal, because of his lack of faithfulness. He will be able to turn back into relationship in a way that will strengthen the brethren who who are themselves in need of this kind of healing. So the idea of a church leadership that has the capacity to reconcile because it has itself experienced this reconciliation, this falling and being strengthened, is part of the vision of leadership that is provided even in the New Testament itself. On the Mount of Olives, this terrible irony, Peter declares in verse 33, this is again in segment number 7 from Matthew 26, though all fall away, I will never fall away. Peter blustering, making a promise he absolutely will not keep, because as we find in the next section, the betrayal in the courtyard, vignette number 8, here Peter tragically, having seen Christ led away, now speaks the terrible truth he finds within his own heart. He is unfortunately not lying when he says to the woman, "Ouk oida auton," I do not know him. At some level, Peter is, again, not being duplicitous. He's discovered in his own heart he doesn't know what it means for Christ to be the Messiah. The one who was transfigured on the mountain is now going to suffer, and Peter doesn't know what that means. He doesn't know who Christ is. At some level, what he's saying is, I don't know him. Have I ever known him? And when he's asked, are you one of them? He says, I am not. Ouk eimi, which is a kind of a terrible reversal even of the divine name. I am who am. I am not. And again, it's not that Peter is lying. The tragedy is at that moment, he's speaking what is real and in his heart. And he says to the other, you were with him, he's a Galilean man, I do not know what you are saying. There's a kind of a plumbing the depths of disappointment, of a sense of having been rejected by the God you thought you committed yourself to, which is itself an act of rejection and betrayal, but Peter is restored. And so in vignette number 9, and I've highlighted kind of parallel sections in verses 15, 16, and 17, Peter's specific restoration. But let's above that look at the context of what precedes it. Again, I'm going fishing. It's as if Peter has said, all of what went before, now I cast behind me. I'm going back to what I knew, but there he is, and it's almost as if the call is repeated. Peter, who is almost stepping away from, has certainly stepped out of relationship with the Lord, stepped back into his old profession, is now called in a way that beautifully parallels his original call. They caught nothing. Jesus invites them to cast the net differently. They do. It's a miraculous catch. John says it is the Lord, but Peter jumps into the sea. So Peter is eager to return. He, with the same zeal and sort of heart-rending disappointment he knew before, now turns back to Christ and is allowed in this beautiful section in verses 15, 16, and 17 to unsay each of his previous denials. For each, I do not know him. I do not know the man. For each of those denials, he's allowed to instead say, in response to Christ's, do you love me? Do you love me more than these? Peter can say, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. You know that I love you. You know everything. You know that I love you. And we can lay aside the exegetical question, does the alternation back and forth between agapao and philein, does that have any real significance in terms of the question that Christ is asking? On some level, that doesn't matter. The fundamental point is that Simon Peter is being restored. Each of the betrayals is being turned into a deepening, a strengthening, so that he can now be again what he was before. And he is restored, and then almost beautifully, whimsically, he suddenly turns back into his old self again. He looks at John, who knows this special relationship with the Lord, who was resting on the breast of the Lord, and he says in an almost kind of irked or almost jealous way, what about him? And Jesus says, well, you are to follow me. Your responsibility is to follow after me. So there can continue to be the old Peter manifesting itself, but always there is the possibility of its being transformed through deeper faithfulness into something new. And that's effectively what we find in this final little segment, this is the Quo Vadis story of Peter's martyrdom. It's taken from the apocryphal Acts of Peter. And again, this is not a historical text. This is a window into the minds and hearts and fantasies and questions of the early church, perhaps the second century. The exact date of this story is a little unclear. But it's a tradition that says in some ways that what Peter was before Christ's death and resurrection, he remained after, and yet always had the ability to be offered by God an opportunity for a deepening union with the Lord. And the issue is a very real one. What happens if a bishop is in danger of being martyred? Should the bishop give himself up, or should he allow himself to be hidden for the sake of the flock? Peter is asking, shall we run away, brethren? Because martyrdom is imminent. And the response is, they say, yes, that way you would save the Lord. And as he's leaving Rome, he has this vision of Christ who says, I must now go back to Rome to be crucified. That tells Peter that he must return. He must be faithful to his Lord yet again. And the beautiful phrase, which I've highlighted and read, kai elthon eis eauton, he came to himself. This is the same phrase that is used in the parable of the prodigal son, who, after having lived apart, after having squandered his heritage, comes into himself, literally goes into himself, discovers who he is, and arises. So Peter, too, is discovering again a possibility of a deeper faithfulness and emulates the Lord by himself dying, crucified, but crucified head downwards, because he thinks that this is a more humble way not to precisely imitate the Lord. So these vignettes from the scriptures and also from the Quo Vadis story are reminders of the fact that Peter is a powerful example of church leadership, which can offer a reconciliation based on its own experience, and a model of discipleship. One looks to the leader as one who is themselves capable of being forged in the crucible of betrayal and restoration, and then who can minister from that experience to us. And perhaps there's also a hint in the meal that precedes Peter's restoration in St. John's Gospel of a Eucharistic context, perhaps a sense of the significance of the sacraments in the process of this restoration. But as we shall see, that theme is much more fully developed in later examples of church leaders.